In 2011, the San Francisco Symphony celebrates its 100th season. Since 1925, the orchestra has been making recordings. I'm Scott Fogelsong, a contributing writer and pre-concert lecturer here at the Symphony. For some years now, I've been exploring the Symphony's long and distinguished history and recorded sound, a vast treasure of music preserved in commercial recordings, in radio broadcasts, and from the Symphony's own archives. I invite you to join me in these podcasts as I share some of my favorite moments drawn from 85 years of great recordings by the musicians of the San Francisco Symphony. On this podcast, Seiji Ozawa's tenure at the San Francisco Symphony from 1970 to 1977. In terms of the symphony's audio history, the Ozawa era is particularly notable for two important developments. First of all, the symphony returned to the recording studio after a decade-plus hiatus. But the old relationship with RCA Victor was over for the time being. Now, the San Francisco Symphony was to record on Deutsche Grammophon, home of the Berlin and Vienna Philharmonic Orchestras. After three successful releases on Deutsche Grammophon, the symphony then moved to Philips. That fine Dutch label would release a steady stream of symphony albums until 1984. The second development is, if anything, even more important than the return to the recording studio. Starting in 1972, the San Francisco Symphony began keeping an in-house recorded archive of its concerts, a practice it has sustained ever since. That archive changes everything. Our audio documentation of the San Francisco Symphony prior to 1972 is spotty, to say the least. Before 1972, the symphony did not record its own concerts, nor did it keep copies of all of its commercial recordings. Not all of those commercial records have been easy to acquire, given that some had only a short shelf life and were never re-released. The in-house archive not only ensures the survival of many more performances, but it also preserves those performances in higher fidelity than can be captured via an FM radio broadcast. Consider Ozawa's performance of the Brahms Third Symphony from January 25, 1974. As it happens, I have two copies of that performance, one from the symphony's archive, and the other a dub of the KKHI broadcast made by a home listener. Here's the home dub. And here's the symphony's archive copy. Some of the archived concerts sound as though the orchestra played them just yesterday. What I wouldn't give to have similar archives for earlier eras and high-quality in-house recordings would have been possible all the way through the Horda and Cripps eras. Ah, well. The Symphony's return to the recording studio was the Three Romeos album on Deutsche Grammophon. It consisted of excerpts from Berlioz's Romeo and Juliet and Prokofiev's ballet score, together with Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet fantasy overture, all packaged in an elaborate gatefold album. Here's a bit of the Berlioz, dubbed from a copy of the LP. Thank you. Despite his Japanese heritage, Seiji Ozawa built up a reputation early on as an exponent of American music. For his next two Deutsche Grammophon albums, Ozawa focused on American works. George Gershwin's An American in Paris has been a popular orchestral showpiece since its 1928 premiere and 1929 premiere recording. Ozawa gives it a solid reading, maybe a little too solid. Consider the famous blues passage in the full orchestra. It's gorgeously played, but it sounds rather Brahmsian. In Michael Tilson Thomas's 1998 recording, the romantic heroism is replaced with the liquid and almost boozy sound of the jazz age. A tendency towards caution marks several of Ozawa's commercial recordings. The performance of Leonard Bernstein's Symphonic Dances from West Side Story is precise, clear, clean, and beautifully played, but it lacks passion. Here's a bit of the mambo. By way of contrast, here's Leonard Bernstein himself conducting the piece in 1961 with the New York Philharmonic. Now that's passion. But Ozawa wasn't always cautious. One of the big hits of his catalog was an utterly unbuttoned romp through William Russo's street music with harmonica player Corky Siegel. Thank you. Ozawa also released another William Russell work, Three Pieces for Blues Band, also highly successful. When Ozawa and the symphony moved to the Philips label, they recorded several standard repertory items, Beethoven's Eroica Symphony and two works by Dvorak, the New World Symphony and the Carnival Overture. Thanks to the in-house archive, we can hear the difference between Ozawa live and Ozawa in the studio, where he tended to be more cautious. Consider the Dvorak Carnival Overture in the 1975 studio recording. The Carnival Overture was on the regular subscription programs the previous season. Here's an archive recording from April 11th, 1974. Quite a difference. Ozawa's 1975 studio recording of Beethoven's Eroica just might be the most relaxed rendition of the work ever committed to disc. Consider the first movement in Herbert Blumstedt's 1991 Decca recording, its tempo thoroughly in keeping with mainstream norms. Now here's the Ozawa. It's really more an andante rather than Beethoven's indicated allegro con brio. But Ozawa could conform to accepted norms in Beethoven. Consider his December 6, 1974 live performance of the Ninth. Beethoven indicated a tempo of quarter note equals 116 for the second movement scherzo. Most conductors run between that to about 120 or so. Ozawa's tempo is 118. By the way, in 1977, Ado Dvar took the same passage at 121, also very close to the norm. Although he was often associated with contemporary music, Seiji Ozawa displayed a fondness for the great German masters in his San Francisco programs. One very welcome presence on those programs is Joseph Haydn. Ozawa programmed a surprising number of Haydn works, and not all of them were drawn from the late London symphonies favored by most conductors. For example, The programmatic Il Distrato Symphony No. 60 popped up in April 1972, while in 1973 San Francisco heard the rarely performed Symphony No. 73. And in 1975, we got the superb early Symphony No. 31 that's nicknamed the Horn Signal due to its quartet of horns. In 1974, Ozawa even programmed one of Haydn's delectable Nocturnes for the King of Naples, originally scored for two lire organizzate, which were hybrid hurdy-gurdies with both string and wind sounds. Clarinets take their place in this performance. You'll note that in the 1970s, the historically informed performance movement hadn't yet caught on in mainstream ensembles. So Ozawa's Haydn performances might sound a bit old-style to our ears. Former symphony directors Alfred Hertz, Pierre Monteux, and Joseph Cripps were all noted for their skill with Brahms. And Seiji Ozawa definitely upheld that tradition. In May 1973, he gifted San Francisco audiences with a warmly compassionate and elegantly contoured Second Symphony. That was one of Pierre Monteux's signature works, by the way. As a cultural ambassador from Japan to America, Ozawa made a point of introducing Japanese soloists to San Francisco audiences. Among those soloists was the young violinist Mayumi Fujikawa, then in the early years of what has proven to be a fine career. Here she is, playing the Glazunov Violin Concerto on March 29, 1974. There was nothing stuffy about Seiji Ozawa or his programming. He was adventurous enough to offer a concert version of the first act of Wagner's Die Walküre with soprano Jesse Norman. Here's a bit from the May 5, 1977 performance. Thank you. Ozawa delighted audiences with his performance of John Cage's Toy Piano in May 1974. He began by playing Cage's original on a bright red Baby Baldwin toy piano, then followed with Lou Harrison's orchestration of the work. Ozawa brought a lot of important contemporary music to San Francisco. One of the triumphs of his early career on record had been Olivier Messiaen's monumental Turangalila Symphony. His 1967 RCA Red Seal recording in Toronto remains a discographic landmark. Ozawa brought Turangalila to San Francisco during the 1974-75 season. If I may inject a personal note here, I had just arrived in San Francisco as a graduate student in January 1975, and I went to the symphony as soon as I possibly could. I'm pretty sure that the Messiaen performance was the first time I heard the San Francisco Symphony live, after having grown up listening to Monteuse and Horda's commercial recordings. It's been a thrill to relive that concert, thanks to the symphony's archives. Here is the second Chanson d'Amour from January 18, 1975, with Yvonne Loriod on piano and Jeanne Loriod playing the Ondes Martinon, an early electronic instrument. Another Ozawa blockbuster was the Fourth Symphony by Charles Ives, one of the most memorable events of the 1972-73 season, and a work that the symphony took on its first ever European tour, another major event of the Ozawa era. This excerpt comes from the Friday, May 11th performance. The Ives Fourth has a difficult and exposed piano part. It was played by staff pianist Robin Sutherland, now a veteran well into his fourth decade in the symphony. But back then, he was so new to the orchestra that radio announcer Bill Agee didn't even know his name.
I'm sorry I neglected to get the name of the young man who's been playing the piano at the very front. Very front of the stage. Maestro Ozawa shook his hand and applauded him, too.
During much of his tenure, Ozawa tried to hold down a double directorship on opposite coasts, jet-setting between San Francisco and Boston. But eventually Boston won out, where he settled in for an unprecedented 29-year run. He's still making music, until recently as the principal conductor of the Vienna Staatsoper. His time in San Francisco might have been brief, but it was an important period in the symphony's history. Ozawa left the symphony just a few years before it moved out of the shared War Memorial Opera House and into its own permanent home. It would be Ado DeVart who presided over a newly full-time San Francisco symphony, as we will cover on my next podcast.